Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Noble Ruin, Mark Antony, Civil War, and the Collapse of the Roman Republic by W. Jeffrey Tatum. Narrated by Christopher Grove. Preface. In his lifetime, Mark Antony was a famous man, and he played a leading role in the transformation of the Roman world. The fall of the Roman Republic and the imposition of the Augustan Age articulate a truly crucial epoch in European and Mediterranean history and culture. Antony was a central figure in this transformation. Consequently, he remains famous, or infamous, and an object of recurring academic study. His life, variegated, passionate, sensual, bold, tragic, in a sense, inspires vigorous reactions. Nearly everyone has a view on Antony, and the habit began early. For Cicero, Antony was distasteful, a talented man who was also a bad man, and Cicero said so in vitriolic speeches, the Philippics, which soon became central to the ancient world's curriculum in oratory. Antony's enemies, not least Octavian, put Cicero's vituperation to work in fashioning him as a dangerous failure, a Roman noble corrupted by his appetites and his lust for Cleopatra. Later historians adopted and adapted these themes, delivering their readers an Antony who was irresistibly depraved, startlingly brave, sometimes cunning, but almost always constitutionally incapable of choosing the right side of history. The biographer Plutarch, relying on the same material, crafted a life whose protagonist was great-natured, but too philosophically inept, too simple and naive to resist temptation, be it food and drink, levity, luxury, or feminine beauty. Plutarch's Cleopatra enduringly embodies all these dangerous attractions. She, and the deceptions lurking in what the Greek biographer deplores as Oriental ostentation, lead Antony fatally astray. Plutarch's influence is nothing less than formidable. His Antony is very much the chivalrous and unstudied Antony of Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra, and Ronald Symes's The Roman Revolution. And in reacting to it by emphasizing Antony's acumen and sophistication, there is always a danger of forgetting that, in the end, Octavian won, and Antony lost. Investigations of Antony or topics involving Antony are legion, nor can any fair-minded person complain that there are too few biographies of the man. Which raises the question, is another one otiose? Obviously, I hope not. Justifying a new account of Antony's life by cataloguing deficiencies in one's predecessors, however, is an exercise which is both unattractive and unfair. Indeed, many are superb. No biographer of Antony will ever excel the clarity and charm of Chamu, the cleverness of Rossi, and the acumen of Hoffmann inspire admiration. English readers have long relied on Huszár's Mark Antony, a biography. This book will soon be half a century old, which means that, through no fault of his own, its account misses recent discoveries and is unaffected by the many changes in our ways of thinking about the late Republic that have taken place since its appearance. A new biography presents a fresh opportunity for taking advantage of what are undeniable advances in our understanding of the fall of the Republic and the triumviral period which followed, and in our appreciation of the dynamics of Rome's government of the Eastern Mediterranean, where Antony, for the last decade of his life, was master. This biography is written for more than one audience. It is accessible to any listener, or at least I hope it is. In the body of the text, all Latin and Greek is translated or explained, and throughout this volume, there is more than one excursion aimed at clarifying technical matters essential for understanding Antony's career. These are by no means digressions, but classicists and ancient historians may prefer to skip them. I confess that I have not read everything there is to read which is pertinent to Mark Antony, nor, of what I have read, have I cited everything here. the omission of any previous scholarly work should not be viewed as an implicit criticism of it. Ancient historians, I hope, will find things in this book which they judge to be both new and true, but I do not expect mine to be the final word on Antony or the times in which he lived. The study of the past is always a work in progress, and very little in Roman history is settled business. Most of what I have to say about Antony is necessarily provisional. No biography of an ancient figure can furnish a listener with the kind of psychological depth one expects in modern life-writing. We know too little of Antony's private world to try to unpack his personality by way of detailed descriptions of specific episodes or by way of applying sophisticated methodologies as a means of filling in the gaps. His inner being and its urges, so important for contemporary biographers, elude us, and there is very little we can do about it. Perhaps this is not such a bad thing, after all. In John Lanchester's splendid novel Capital, one of its more adept operatives, the man who shares the company of many notable people, is keenly aware of the gap between celebrities and their public. Mickey knew plenty of things that people were desperate to know, most of them variations on the theme of, what is X really like? As if there were a special category of knowledge called really likeness, as if it were somehow the ultimate question. As if, indeed. What Antony was really like, we shall never know, which puts us in the same position as the bulk of his contemporaries. Still, in trying to make a sense of his career, we can certainly get glimpses of the person who played the part. 1. Beginning. Noble Antony. Mark Antony was a nobilis, a Roman noble. The Latin word means noted or famous, but nobilitas refers to fame of a distinctive brand. All Roman senators were distinguished men. By definition, they were optimi, the best men of the city, but few were nobles. Orators and jurists, and especially triumphant generals, garnered glory in abundance, celebrity which remained within the reach of any senator, if he was good enough. Nobility, however, was a property of birth. Although scholars still squabble over the exact definition of nobilitas, all agree that individuals descending from the consuls or dictators were esteemed by the Roman public as nobilis. Nobility, then, was an aristocracy of birth, but one predicated on exceptional individual achievement in the service of the Republic, an origin that imbued the nobility with a legitimacy, grounded in what we might describe as a myth of meritocracy. Central to any Roman's claim to greatness was virtus, a word which fundamentally means manliness. And in patriarchal Rome, that sense of the word was never lost. But virtus gathered to itself every facet of individual excellence in public life. Consequently, the concept was central to the ideology of the aristocracy. As one modern scholar has put it, for the Roman aristocrat, virtus consisted in the winning of personal eminence and glory by the commission of great deeds in the service of the Roman state. It designated the right stuff, something possessed only by a few, and it ran in families. Everyone in Rome tended towards the belief that virtus was hereditary. Hence the natural conclusion that the descendants of great men were possessed of a fiber superior to others, even among the aristocracy. The fame of a nobilis was not mere glamour. It resided in the conviction of others that he was exactly the kind of man the Republic needed. The nobilis' excellence, a consequence of his birth, was manifest in his actions. Industria, hard work, was also an aristocratic virtue in Rome, and all grandees were obliged to devote themselves in aiding their friends and dependents, by way of legal advice or advocacy, gifts to the needy, and sometimes by offering protection to anyone beleaguered by dangerous foes. A Roman aristocrat sought to become the refuge of many, and exhibited his grandeur by holding court in his mansion. Each day began with a morning levee, called a salutatio, at which all were welcome, and no visitor's request too trivial to be heard. Whereas the modern habit is to communicate one's importance to others by throwing up barriers and insisting on inaccessibility, and by exhibiting an inclination to say no, at Rome the great and the good acted otherwise, indeed so much so that ordinary people expected their betters to be available whenever they needed them, and were angry on those occasions when their petitions were rejected. Even as a young man, an aristocrat and a noble, most of all, was expected to be active in assisting others in the forum, where trials and other legal business were transacted. In exchange for this industry, an aristocrat expected esteem. Roman aristocrats, and nobles especially, were rich men. This wealth, which was principally landed wealth, set them apart for all the obvious reasons, but also because it enabled its owner to devote himself to lavishing attention and benefactions on individuals at every level of society. Through what the historian Sallust called the might of their kindred and the multitude of their dependents, a noble, by being helpful in a way no one else could be, put himself in the center of an extensive network of freedmen and clients, neighbors, friends, foreign connections, aristocratic clubs, even financiers and businessmen, each of whom owed him a favor, or more likely, many favors. A grandee's good works were by no means selfless. Every benefaction shackled its recipient with an inevasible debt of gratitude, of gratia. Romans were obsessed with the practical and moral claims of gratitude, and ingratitude was abominated. It was very nearly impossible for anyone to deny a request from a man or woman to whom he owed a favor. Gratia, for this reason, was a key foundation of aristocratic clout. Glory and honor were earned not only by way of personal favors, but also indeed principally through benefactions to the Republic. The many civic labors undertaken by aristocrats, pleading or advising in the courts, serving in the legions as an officer, were acts of public service. These men did not take a salary. They strove for fame. Likewise, when they held magistracies or sat in the Senate, this too was a civic duty, not a job. A senator's recompense was power and admiration by a grateful public. Roman grandees relished their crowded levies and boasted about them, and they invidiously observed any applause received by their peers. In everything they did, they strained themselves in seeking recognition for it. Prestige, dignitas, for most in the aristocracy, was their ultimate concern. This was truer for a noble than for anyone. A classic statement of the values and ambitions animating the Roman noble was the panegyric delivered by the noble Quintus Metellus at the funeral of his noble father, Lucius Metellus. Lucius, we learn, achieved the 10 greatest distinctions in pursuit of which men with sound judgment devote their lives. He made it his aim to be the best of warriors, the finest orator, the bravest general, the magistrate under whose auspices the greatest deeds are accomplished, holder of the Republic's highest magistracy, to be supremely intelligent, to be recognized as the most distinguished senator, to obtain great wealth by honorable means, to leave behind many sons, and to be the most famous citizen in Rome. The noble, in this formulation, is not like anyone else, and endeavors to be better even than his peers. His aim is to be recognized by all as the best man, the most valorous, the best educated, the most eloquent, the most statesmanlike, in the Republic. This noble pose is as idealized as it is ambitious. There were ugly sides to the nobility. Jealous rivals often depicted the nobility as an inert class, the abundant legacies of which permitted its members an easy ascent to greatness. Cicero can say of the noble Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus that he had spent the whole of his life as a consul designate. Rivals of the nobility, especially politicians who lacked illustrious antecedents, grumbled over nobles' advantages. He was shielded by family fame, by credit for the deeds, the triumphs and the consulships of his ancestors, by an abundance of wealth and personal connections, all of it inherited, none of it earned. Some denounced the nobility for its pretensions. Sallust spoke for many when he complained how, for all their claims to virtus, too many nobles lacked real courage or even experience in warfare. Instead, they devoted their energies toward decadent ends. Luxury and greed and debauchery were their true pursuits. Worst of all, he complained, nobles were insufferably arrogant and even savage when protecting their paramountcy. In a letter to a provincial governor, Cicero urges him not to offend Antony's brother Lucius. Slighting a young man who is formidable and a noble, he warns, will incite the enmity of many. The orator was not alone in reckoning arrogance and condescension as hallmarks of noble conduct. Indeed, aspersions of this kind reflected a widely shared view of the nobility. Rhetorical handbooks, for instance, put these negative premises to work when instructing an orator on the best means of stirring a jury's resentment against a Roman noble. A pleader is advised to draw attention to his overbearingness bordering on violence, clout, alliances, riches, his complete lack of inhibition in asserting superiority over others, his nobility, clients, contacts, networks, and kinsmen. Like the heroic figure emerging from Metellus's panegyric, this dark portrayal of the noble is also a stereotype. It will not do to split the difference, but doubtless many nobles in various ways combined qualities from both paradigms. The Roman people were willing to take the bad with the good. Clearly, Roman voters accepted the claim that their nobles were superior men, the proof of which is that, during the last 2 centuries of the Republic, the vast majority of consulships, Rome's highest magistracy, went only to men who were nobilis. Only rarely did anyone from outside the nobility make it to the top. And it was even more uncommon for a man who was the first in his family to attain the rank of a senator, a novus homo, or new man, to become a consul. In the view of the nobility, the anomaly of a new man's holding the consulship was nothing short of sacrilege. The office, they complained, was polluted by its association with any novus homo, however impressive his accomplishments. Even after Cicero, a new man, reached this office, in the teeth of prevailing prejudices and outpolling his noble colleague, Gaius Antonius, Mark Antony's uncle, he was admired by the nobility, but never really accepted by them. And yet he ennobled his family. Great man though he was, Cicero remained a novus homo all his life. His son, by contrast, was nobly born, and he notoriously despised the glorious Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa, a new man. For all the success of the nobility, nobilitas was not and must never become a magic word. Most consuls were nobles, yes, but most nobles failed to make it to the consulship, so steep was the competition. Roman history is littered with noble failures, and it was actually remarkably rare for a noble family to preserve its political eminence over several generations. Misadventure, misfortune, sloth, or sheer incompetence could blight even a noble's future. Which is why a noble, like everyone else in the aristocracy, and notwithstanding his undeniable advantages, had to work very hard to hang on to his place at the top. The demands of his heritage rendered it impossible for a noble to remain undisgraced by mediocrity. He must attain the consulship in the teeth of competition from his peers, as well as ambitious and talented inferiors. For this reason, nobles were ferocious when defending their prestige. This was as true of Mark Antony as it was of any noble. In his fierce contest with Octavian, who was the son of a novus homo, Antony savagely ridiculed his enemy's obscure origins. His great-grandfather, he sneered, was a freedman from the countryside who made ropes, and his grandfather was a sordid money-changer. None of this was true. Octavian's family derived from the local aristocracy, a velitrae. But the point of Antony's acerbity was not accuracy, but rather to underline with graphic brutality the enormous social gulf separating him from his upstart rival. In Rome, this gulf mattered very much. Rome's political aristocracy. The civic life of Rome was animated by its two dynamic principles, the people's majesty and the Senate's authority. Only the people, in their various assemblies, were competent to pass legislation, and it was the people who elected the executive magistrates, who went on to become senators. The people were, in a very real sense, sovereign. It is fitting, even Cicero concedes, that all powers, all commands, all commissions are granted by the Roman people. The people did not, however, draft or deliberate legislative proposals, nor were the people responsible for supervising Rome's financial affairs or its civic religion or its foreign policy. These were matters that, by custom or law, had been handed over to the Senate, the body of former magistrates who, by dint of their collective experience and wisdom, were deemed best equipped for addressing the realities of statecraft. Thus the Senate's dominating influence resided principally in its prestige, its auctoritas. It tendered its advice to the people, and the people's magistrate not by way of laws, but by way of decrees. It was traditional, which is to say, it was very much a moral obligation, for both magistrates and the public to defer. Neither the Senate nor the people could act without the leadership of the magistrates. Only magistrates possessed the capacity for summoning and addressing the Senate, for summoning and addressing the people, or for putting forward legislative proposals. In dealing with the people, a magistrate needed eloquence and social confidence. When he spoke before the public, and the administration of the Republic often demanded these face-to-face encounters, he did so at an assembly known as a contio. Anyone could attend, and every speaker's audience enjoyed the liberty of cheering or jeering, or simply departing. Sometimes they threw things. In Rome, popular sovereignty was not an abstraction diluted by the realities of representative government. In the courts, which also operated outdoors and in public, in the provinces, and in warfare, magisterial leadership was indispensable, and its responsibilities exacting. Their specific duties and powers varied. Aediles, for instance, maintained the fabric of the city and produced important religious festivals. Praetors presided over the courts and governed provinces. Consuls held sway in the city, sustained order, and presided over the Senate. Tenure of these magistracies was limited to a single year, and a minimum age was prescribed for each. These offices could be held only in a prescribed sequence, nor could they be held in successive years, a rule designed to prevent any individual from holding unbroken power. By Antony's day, a man animated by political aspirations stood for the quaestorship at around 30, or, in his early 30s, the office of tribune of the plebs. These were highly responsible positions. A tribune had the power to stymie any magisterial or governmental activity he deemed harmful to a citizen or detrimental to the good of the Republic. Even popular legislation could be blocked if he forbade it through his veto. At the same time, tribunes could convoke the Senate or propose and carry legislation. These offices offered a Roman entry into the Senate. The most important of the magistrates, however, were the praetors and consuls. These men were invested with imperium, the capacity to command armies or administer justice. The consulship was Rome's highest and most prestigious office, the supreme glory of a public career, as Cicero heralds it. Only two men in each year were elected consuls, and only after they had advanced through the quaestorship and praetorship with enough distinction to surpass their rivals. Reaching the consulship was so momentous an achievement that ex-consuls, the consulares, enjoyed the first rank in the Senate. For a noble like Antony, this supreme glory was the object of his public career. Not every Roman aristocrat aimed at a senatorial career. Those who did not remained members of the equestrian order. They were the equites, or knights, the wealthy class who, the Romans believed, originally furnished the city with its cavalry. The differences between a senator and an equestrian were very real. A senator employed in civic service enjoyed greater prestige and superior honor. But despite these distinctions, senators and equestrians belonged to the same class. They inhabited the same social world, were products of the same brand of education, shared the same cultural pursuits. Both senators and equestrians could look back on younger days when both served as officers and held minor offices. Indeed, a senator was an equestrian at the start. It was only after he was elected quaestor, or tribune, and entered the Senate that he surrendered his equestrian status. It was at that point in his career that his life diverged in important ways from his equestrian coevals. Still, they were hardly separate species. The relationship between senators and equites has been encapsulated neatly. There was more to unite the two orders than to divide them. Eschewing a public career, an equestrian was free to spend his time as he liked. Some became fabulously wealthy financiers. Many, like Cicero's friend Atticus, invested widely, grew richer, and offered practical aid to busy senators, whose careers they helped to foster. Most remained devoted agriculturalists, even those who also engaged in manufacture or trade or finance. The individual contentiousness that characterized senatorial competition was unnecessary, and often unhelpful for this branch of the aristocracy, which is not to say equestrians were unpolitical or irresponsible in civic affairs. Every Roman jury, for instance, included a panel of knights, and collectively the equestrian order mattered a great deal in Roman elections. As individuals, moreover, because they were close, sometimes indispensable, to their senatorial friends and relations, they enjoyed considerable personal influence, but were often, for this same reason, very much affected by senatorial politics. Equestrian actors are not always visible to us in our ancient sources. Atticus is the most conspicuous, owing to Cicero's letters, and Nepos's biography of the man. If his views and activities are any guide to the sentiments and preoccupations of his peers, then at least some equestrians remained close to the centers of power in Rome, both by way of economic ties, but also through bonds of high culture and shared political values. What's in a name? The formal name of the man we know as Mark Antony was M. Antonius, capital M, period, lowercase f, period, capital M, period, lowercase n, period, C-O-R, period, comma. Marcus Antonius, son of Marcus, grandson of Marcus of the Cornelian tribe. Every Roman belonged to one of the Republic's 35 tribes. These were not affiliations founded on ethnicity or kinship, but rather slices of society based on region and feelings of neighborliness, and which operated very much like modern voting districts. As for embedding in one's name the identity of one's father and grandfather, this is a habit of nomenclature that exhibits Roman patriarchy in a way so obvious it requires no further comment. Every man had at least two names, and most had three. The first name, or praenomen, was a given name. The Romans had so very few of these that they could be abbreviated without causing confusion. His second name, his nomen, indicated his gens, a word sometimes rendered clan. If a Roman had a third name, which Antony did not, that was his cognomen, originally a kind of nickname, which was preserved to provide further definition for a family. Among the Claudians, for example, there were Claudii, Pulcri, Claudii Neronis, and so forth. Romans recycled the same names over several generations, and this can lead to confusion on our part. Women ordinarily had only a single name, the feminine form of their father's nomen. Antony's daughters were each of them Antonia. Not everyone named Antonius was related to one another. Within each gens, there were collateral branches so distant from one another that it makes no sense to talk about a relationship, and there were families the names of which became homonymous over time. Moreover, whenever a Roman freed a slave, that slave usually took as his or her name the nomen of his or her owner. When Marcus Tullius Cicero freed his learned slave Tiro, that man became Marcus Tullius Tiro. Newly enfranchised citizens also adopted a Roman nomen, often the name belonging to the agent of his enrollment. For this reason, not everyone named Antonius is a kinsman, even a distant kinsman, or even a loose connection of our Antony. Indeed, by the end of the first century, there were Antonii all over the Mediterranean world, most of whom...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?